This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. It's my regular show with Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician. And today we are also checking in with Dato Dr. Amar Singh, HSS, consultant pediatrician and advisor to the National Early Childhood Intervention Council, or NECIC. What we're going to be talking today is about how we can help children, especially those with special needs, to catch up after the pandemic. Now, we know that for the past 2 years and a little more, most children in Malaysia have had a major loss in education progress. Now, the challenges are even more pronounced for children with special needs. And we know what a wide range that could cover. We are not just looking at children with physical issues, but also intellectual, developmental, or learning challenges. So what has been the impact of the last 2 years on these vulnerable children, and what should we prioritize to help them catch up in terms of learning as well as social and emotional development? So, Dr. Rajini and Dr. Amar, so glad to have you on with me. How are the both of you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you very much for having us here, shall we?
Thanks, shall we? We're good and hope everybody's good too.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, good, I suppose, is relative. I know as a parent myself, many issues that we're juggling with every day, and with our kids back in school, it's both a sigh of relief, but also at the same time, many other challenges have come up, isn't it, in terms of where our kids are, you know, learning-wise, what they may be struggling with on a daily basis in the classroom itself. So I think overall, Dr. Rajini, with kids having lost these last 2 years of their childhood, how significant are these losses when we look at their development and learning? And I wanted to find out across the board, not just schooling, but also non-schooling children.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can look at it, you can divide it into different aspects. Yeah, for the younger kids, overall development, their motor skills, their social communication skills, their problem-solving skills, and that's all with being confined at home for most of the time. For those who are in the preschool age, I know the focus is on learning, but for me, the bigger problem has been the social communication, the ability to regulate their emotions in different settings, you know, because they've haven't had that exposure, that practice. And of course, you know, with the school-going children, for many of them, and we were just having this discussion, we're not even talking about children with special needs. We're just talking about children generally, being stuck at home, having lost that time for learning, having lost that time interacting with their peers, having more time to go on, you know, online sort of platforms and gadgets, etc. It's affected not just their learning, but also their emotional well-being. And you know, as you know, before we can talk about learning, we've got to talk about, you know, being able to manage just their well-being mentally, physically, socially as well.
And Amar, for children with special needs, then, you know, what do we need to be even more sensitive about?
Well, I think that, you know, I'd like to come back a little bit to what Ranjini said. You know, we've lost more than 40 weeks of school closure. That's the full period of school closure, one of the largest in the world, actually. And most people now talk about this term called learning loss or education poverty, and we've got one of the highest in the world. I think for special needs children, what's happened is that for the younger ones, we haven't been able to prepare them for school entry. If you're not ready for school, you're not school ready as a special needs child, you're going to struggle enormously when you come into school. And for the last 2 years, a lot of early intervention programs have actually shut down. Even the kindergartens, we've lost 25% of our preschool services in the last 2 years. So a lot of children haven't been able to attend because they've got developmental problems. They haven't got these services. They're just not school ready. And now they're suddenly plunked into Standard 1, or some of them are in Standard 2, and they don't have the abilities to cope with that that place. Secondly, I think some of them had physical disabilities like cerebral palsy and Down syndrome. And for that reason, people were worried about higher COVID risk in them. And I noticed that they were the last classes to open in MOE, the Ministry of Education school, were the ones with special needs because they're concerned. They're first to shut down, but the last to open. And even right now, I think the learning loss in this group of children is very, very much higher than the typically developing children. There's also the group like autism. I think children with autism struggle enormously. They've got a routine in their lives. And lots of kids, you know, would pack their bags, get ready to go to school, but can't go because it's a pandemic on and they don't understand that. A lot of behavior problems. Now, they're going back to school, but they don't want to go back to school because they're comfortable at home, got their parents at home with them. So I think it's a crisis for that many of the special needs parents are facing. And like Rajini said about not developing skills, there's a lot of examples now and data showing regression of skills for these children. And that's very worrying for our special needs kids.
Mm. So, you know, there may be some false assumption that why is learning loss anything to be concerned about when it comes to children with special needs, especially if they have certain learning challenges, for instance, right? There may be that false assumption. Rajini, from your perspective, why is it important to still have them in education, to make them school ready, to support them in these skills?
Yeah, you know, school gives children an opportunity to practice skills in different settings. I like to look at it in that way. Let's just take, for example, you know, a child with a learning difficulty, and even managing himself. You know, the parents took a long time to train him to be independent, dressing himself, toilet training, etc. So part of the whole process of going to school is practicing those self-help skills, right? And what happened during the pandemic is they didn't have to leave the home, or they could not leave the home. They could not go to school. And when they did go back to school for the short periods, for some of them, they needed that practice time to get back into that routine. And to be honest, shall we, for some of these children, they were actually told, oh, we can't have them in school because, you know, we don't have enough people to help them to go to the toilet. Or if you want to send your child back to school, you have to put them in a diaper. Well, there goes the practice of toileting, which that child had achieved before March 2020, for those first 3 months when they started to go to school. You know, and it's those kids that lost out a lot. And I'm not even touching about learning. I mean, Amal probably has more data, but, you know, initially at the end of 2020, early 2021, people were looking at, after a short period of lockdown in the US, you know, that short few, whatever, 8 weeks, 10 weeks of lockdowns was almost equivalent to losing a year in terms of learning scores in mathematics, language, etc. And it was worst in the youngest children. Now, that's not surprising, is it? Because when do you really practice your literacy and numeracy skills? When you go to school, not just in terms of sitting down doing the maths work, etc., but little things like going to the canteen or sharing things with your friends and, you know, there's eight here, I can share with you and you, and okay, we each get so many. You know, all that is practicing numeracy skills. So children lost out on those things as well.
Mm. And Amal, you brought up that, you know, for some children, the prolonged lockdown then led to that feeling of, you know, where they are most comfortable now is at home, and they are having trouble transitioning back into the school routine. So, you know, with schooling having fully resumed now, what are some issues that we're seeing among children with special needs in that transition back? Rajini, maybe you can jump in later as well.
Yeah, I think that overarching is still this fear of COVID. That's something we need to keep in mind. Children do absorb from us our anxiety and our fear. And I've heard from quite a number of children who their concerns about going back and still got to wear a mask and stuff like that. Not all children with special needs can wear a mask. Some have sensory issues and can't wear a mask. So that adds additional concern in their parents. Secondly, I think we mustn't forget that all of us are pandemic fatigued. And so that's parents and teachers as well. We've talked about this mental health pandemic among children, but I think teachers are, you know, and parents are not coping as well. Even I'm not coping so well, I'm sure that's true for all of us. And so I think, you know, the classroom environment is not as patient and as capable as it was before. And we need to recognize that's going to impact the child's learning, especially when children with special needs have a lot of behavioral problems. And that's, I think, the key right now. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of behavioral issues that we are experiencing in classroom right now. Children who don't want to go back, or children who want to go back, but as Ranjini said, can't manage peer interactions, acting up. And so you need a really good teacher to do that. And one teacher trying to manage a couple of kids is quite a challenge. I mean, you
more
know,
than
as parents.
A couple.
Mm. Yes, that's right. More than a couple. Yeah. But, you know, in a, especially in class, there might be a second teacher, though there might not be. It depends on that classroom environment. And so I think the key right now is the enormous behavioral problems we're seeing. It's not just children with autism, but it's children who, you know, are having other disabilities. Learning problems, Down syndrome or cerebral palsy, some who may be bored in class and acting up, lost their personal attention of their parents that they had for these 2 years. It's a dramatic change in environment. It's like perhaps going to UK for holiday for a year and now coming back to Malaysia and trying to adjust with a complete new culture environment and kind of thing. I think that's what they are facing, many of them. Some don't understand it very well, and that's a problem.
Mm, Rajini, what are you hearing from parents?
You know, today I had a case where a child with, you know, sensitivity to sound, the mum described to me how his behaviour regressed recently. You know, for a long time, there haven't been a lot of constructions going on, right? And now constructions are gone ahead full steam. And construction was going on next door. There was drilling, there was knocking, etc. And she realized that something was not right with her son because he was very moody at home. He started to be a little bit more aggressive in some of his behaviors, etc. And teachers were complaining about him. And then she found out that there was construction going on in the building sort of, you know, next to the school. But the teachers were aware that this is not a boy who's entering Standard 1. This is a boy who's been in that school for some time. But nobody was alert or aware. So little things like that meant that, you know, the parents took him out of school for a whole week before the Raya holidays just because they could see he was upset. And, you know, we forget about these little things. Or another boy who had been prepped. Yeah, he went to a boy with autism. He was told that he was ready to go into mainstream. And he went to an intervention program under MOE as well and was said he is ready to go to mainstream. He goes into mainstream. There's 42 in the class. The teacher is tearing her hair out. The school concerned initially was supposed to be single session and then had to be, you know, turned into a two-session school. So it was very difficult to prepare him. And so there were a lot of problems just settling him into school. I'm not even thinking about the other kids who, you know, are entering Standard 1. And, you know, parents are not allowed to go into the schools now in Standard 1. So a lot of little issues like this. And we're not even talking about the learning aspect of it yet.
Absolutely.
And could I chip in? I think that teacher is not just struggling with this child, but 40% of the other children, typically development children, haven't got their ABCs, haven't got the reading writing skills because they haven't had their preschool. They're just not prepared. So now she's got this huge bunch of children who are very different. She's actually got two classes in a sense. One who managed somehow to study because their parents could afford it or have private tutors or do something online and get ready. And the other kids who are not ready. And so you got this whole bunch of kids who actually in a sense, only 5 years old, or 4 years old, not got their reading skills. And that is a frightening thing for our teachers right now. It's a crisis for them.
Mm, and everything else that comes with that routine of learning, sitting at your desk, copying things down from the board, taking in instructions, all of which I think children, is all of that is part of the learning process for children. We have a tweet here from a listener who said that most kids with autism who do not have access to education in Malaysia, and perhaps that's something that comes with caveats, but this listener says, our son used to go to a private centre. The pandemic was a nightmare for us, still going on. Let's come back after the break and and sort of try to look at that a little bit in terms of children with special needs, you know, whether we're talking about developmental, intellectual or physical issues, what's the system like for them now, and how much more challenging has it become with the pandemic, and how can we look forward? I'm speaking to Dr. Rajini Saravanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, and Dr. Amar Singh, consultant pediatrician and advisor to the National Early Childhood Intervention Council. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik. My guests, Dr. Rajini Saravanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, and Dr. Amar Singh, consultant pediatrician and advisor to the National Early Childhood Intervention Council. We're discussing how do we help children with special needs catch up in terms of their learning losses after these last 2 years of 40 weeks of school closure, being out of kindergarten or some sort of preschool setting, out of school. Some children have, even dropped out of school completely. Just so many challenges that children have been facing, more so children with special needs. So again, just to revisit the tweet that came in, a parent that said, their son used to go to a private center. Their son has autism and used to go to a private center, and the pandemic has been a nightmare for these parents. So Amar, if we were to look at, okay, let's take children with autism as a starting point, perhaps, or just children with some form of support needs. What should the education and learning system provide for them?
Maybe I'll take a step back and describe children in four simple groups. Okay, there's a large proportion of our children coming to school who are typical in a sense. They're fine. The education system generally meets their need. I mean, we've gone through that system, many of us. Then there are children with significant disabilities. I'm not going to name specific ones, but perhaps a child with a quadriplegic CP, a child with Down syndrome with a lower intellectual capacity, children like that who have significant needs. These children generally have special education classes available for them and some system to support them. But the larger bulk of children, which is about 10-12% of children who have milder learning problems, a high-functioning child with autism, a child with dyslexia, a child with specific learning disability, these are the large bunch group of children whose needs are not met by our education system. We tend to want to push them into special education classes, but they are better served in inclusive education in mainstream. The problem is we don't have a system to support them there. There's a fourth group which is appearing right now, which is the children who haven't had enough preschool support and just too much screen time, and they need some support. If you look at Ministry of Education data, you will recognize they only pick up about 20% of all the children with special needs. So a lot of children are, pushed to E-class or just told to be lazy or not smart when actually they have a developmental problem that needs support. So right now, I think we just don't have a system. We've got a phenomenal national education blueprint, but the implementation of that is actually very, very sadly lacking. We don't have the important measures that many countries have put in place to welcome the children into mainstream, to offer them the remedial additional support they need, to have the curriculum modification they require, and to value and accept them in the classroom. All those things are missing. So I can empathize with the person who tweeted, most parents tend to go for homeschool or private schooling because they can't get into an MOE school that supports them.
All right. And how much worse have things gotten with the pandemic then? In a way, if a child wasn't in a formal school system, are things actually better for them?
I think if you, in my practice, when I was at Ministry of Health, I would say 50% of children with autism, for example, under my care are in mainstream. But that took a lot of enormous effort. I've got to identify a school that's willing to accept the child, talk to the teachers, have the right letters, I have to pay visits. But increasingly, a lot of parents decide to go to international homeschool, where the curriculum is a lot more flexible, especially homeschool, where you can move that. So I think that's what's happening right now. With the pandemic, I think, Siawek, I'm not sure what's happening. I suspect a lot of people may not have fully sent their children back to school just yet. Some are still struggling financially to even get this kind of services for their children.
Dr. Rajini, you were shaking your head there. Your thoughts?
I think we can't forget, you know, as Zaman was saying earlier, the everyone was scared of COVID. And so for a lot of parents, even sending them to private schools or centers that were open was a problem. They were just too anxious to send their kids back. And, you know, with children, if parents are anxious, parents are stressed, it rubs off on children generally. So, you know, and I think speaking to everyone, haven't spoken to anyone who hasn't felt stressed throughout that whole 2 years, the uncertainty, not knowing what's happening. And hence, we would expect that children, regardless of whether they have special needs or are just typically developing children, would have taken on some of that stress and anxiety and with the loss of school time. Although schools that were registered or centers that were registered under JKM were allowed to open, many of the teachers also were not all coming back. So I think, you know, yes, it I can imagine it was a hell of a time for a lot of families. But, you know, moving forward, we now have to focus on that. And how is it that we're going to help children across the board? Because as Amma says, you know, even there's also a group of children who were typically developing maybe even before this pandemic, but because of the pandemic, because of the social situation, they've not had access to being prepared for school. And so they're entering schools. You know, can you imagine entering at standard two or even standard three? Those in standard three now only had, what, 2 months, barely 2 months, I think, of school, because school started in the second week of January and schools locked down in the middle of their first week holiday in March. So with the Chinese New Year holiday in between, which was another week. So even those children in standard three now, they probably cannot remember what schooling was like before going back to school now.
Mm. So moving forward then, Amar, and you and a group from civil society have prepared a report called A Path to Post-COVID-19 School Recovery in Malaysia. And, just briefly, it's a plan offering key suggestions and initiatives. But, you know, let's look a little bit at that. What was the objective of preparing this? And what are some recommendations that you'd like to highlight?
Okay, I think the reason we wrote this is because we recognize that we are in a national education emergency. I think that's the only way we can describe it. And so we got together to prepare this, to present it to our government, which we had done so. We have presented it to Majlis Pemuluhan Negara to share our ideas. And these are the ideas that don't come alone from us, but come from the best evidence that's available in the world, from UNICEF, from World Bank, from other organizations that are also writing and struggling about this. So these are things that work. They're down to earth to work. I think there are many possible recommendations to look at. I think the first recommendation is perhaps the most important, is we need to know where the child is. If you don't know where the child is, you don't know how to support the child. And you cannot really, you know, just think of it as a standardized testing. You need some measure where you can assess the child individually, and not just the child, but the family. We recognize a lot of families have been pushed into poverty. 1 in 5 children in the city are not coming back because parents are not sending them back. They're going to be pushed somewhere else, maybe co-opted into business with the family. So we need to know the family dynamics and not just child's situation as well. And we must keep this brief. If I know teachers, they are labored with paperwork. And one thing we've asked for MOE is to cut the rest of the paperwork that teachers are facing and focus on this, do a simple thing. And I think we should involve the families in this assessment if we could. I think that's the first step that we can do. The second step is then actually to bring in extra manpower. We've talked a lot about Standard 1 and Standard 2 here, but also transition years. For all the special needs kids, but also the typically developing kids, we need to bring in an extra teacher to support teachers. Teachers are struggling. In the past, it was the healthcare professionals and the frontliners were struggling. But right now, as services are coming back, teachers are really struggling very hard. And we need to bring in extra manpower. And we suggested how this can be done in a reality all over the country. They don't have to be formally trained teachers. They could be school leavers, people who have an educational background, who are then teaching basic skills to Standard 1, Standard 2, and being a support to that teacher in the classroom. The third suggestion is to make it staggered. We can't just rush to standard three. If you miss out on standard one and two, we need to go back a step, maybe two terms of standard one, then another two terms of standard two, then come back to standard three. So we have to overlap into standard four. In addition, we've suggested that some children may need an extra year in school. In the past, this has only been offered to children with special needs, but I think right now we should broaden it. But definitely special needs children will need extra time. I think one very important suggestion we made is financial support for all parents pushed into poverty and those in existing poverty. If they know that for the next 1 to 2 years, they're going to get good financial support, they're going to free their child to come back to school. Otherwise, I think that's not going to happen. For some children who are older, Siarik, I think those with special needs or older who, you know, school doesn't have much meaning for them anymore, perhaps having dialogue with them, push them faster into a vocational training program. We need to give them the skill sets to have a better job than just, you know, becoming a odd jobs worker or a laborer. So I think these are some of the key suggestions. There are many more, but these I think are the ones that perhaps bring value to our children at this time.
So I think a big question in my mind is how can the system, and you've talked about how teachers are already so burdened, how are we going to cope with all this and complete the curriculum on top of everything else? And I know that teachers, for many teachers, that's first and foremost on their minds, sort of like making sure that curriculum is covered, you know. And Dr. Rajini, I know you have shared thoughts in the past about let's not focus on the curriculum so much, right? Let's focus on I don't know, what are your thoughts? Amar, what do you think? First, you know.
Okay, fine. No problem. Coming back to the curriculum, I think we don't need to cover the whole curriculum. We've suggested come down to core subjects, language, math, science, kind of thing. You know, and not that history and geography is not important. I value them, but perhaps at this time, focus on the subjects that thing. But I think coming back to your core question, I like something from UNICEF. UNICEF wrote a very good evidence-based document which talked about core capacities for living and learning. 9 evidence-based areas that they suggest are the best for learning, for school, and for long-term life and performance. And let me just describe a few of them. They talk about developing listening and observing skills for children. That's very, very important. They talk about reflective skills in children. So actually what they're trying to teach us here is teach them how to learn, not so much what to learn. They also talk about inquiring skills, empathizing skills, so you understand what other people are saying and see from another perspective. And most important, perhaps, discerning patterns, they call this, which is a way of looking at the bigger picture, seeing how things fit together and understanding that. So I know we want to teach them academic learning. We want to teach them social skills and emotional regulation, as Ranjini talked about, and independent living for the special need kids. But I think the most important thing is we want to inculcate in children an ability to learn. Because we're not talking about pass or fail. I hate that kind of system. We're talking about a child that's constantly learning, constantly growing. And one of the best terms for this is universal design for learning. If the listeners don't hear anything else, listen to this one word, universal design for learning, go and Google it up. This is the style of teaching that many countries have adopted, where we allow a child to learn at their own speed, learn the way they want to learn, and offer them the tools and the resources they need to learn.
Dr. Rajini, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, Amar's given us the technical term, but it's essentially about that, isn't it? Primary school is all about the building blocks for literacy, numeracy, you know, writing, etc. But it's also about developing the motivation to want to learn, that love for learning. And you know, if you burden children with curriculums, I mean, let's just take Sajara for an example. Yeah. I mean, this is a personal thought, not so much. I learned Sajara not as a Sajara subject, but listening to teachers tell us stories. Teachers used to make us act out, you know, the whole Masuri, the legend of Masuri. We got to act it out ourselves. And those are the things that I remembered as I was growing up. And of course, by the time you got to secondary school, when, you know, facts were coming in a little bit more, it made sense when you thought back about what you did when you were in primary school. Mm. Yeah. And you know, the other day, I think a well-meaning teacher decided to do show and tell in the classroom. But instead of giving the children the opportunity to talk about what they wanted to talk about, she decided to break up the curriculum and the topics that were in the textbook, which the children found very boring anyway. And what ended up happening was, I think, you know, it was a lot of cut and paste and just regurgitating what was in the textbook. So that sort of defeated the whole purpose of show and tell, I thought. You know, show and tell should be you come into the classroom and tell them something about what you did, what you enjoyed, what you like at home. Could even be about your teddy bear or the beetle you found in the ground, or, you know, that sort of thing.
It should be child-led.
Yeah, it should be child-led. And I think, you know, building that confidence to speak up and find out information is something that is still really very much lacking. And, you know, this whole thing about copying things from the blackboard, why are we still doing it? What is the purpose? What is even worse is hearing that they have to copy. A child got punished last week because he did not copy what was from the textbook into his exercise book. You know, I thought kudos to that child, you know. He actually thought, why should I
copy? Dr. Rajini, fomenting rebellion from a young age. But that teaches them nothing about, you know, the inquiring skills, you know, which Amar talked about, the independent thinking, right? The discerning skills.
I mean, if you want to teach somebody how to write, why not encourage them to do something like create a card for their mom, or, you know, and it doesn't matter about the spelling and things like that. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure many parents listening are sharing your thoughts as well, Rajini. Amar, in terms of, you know, that brief glimpse you gave us into the full report that your group has prepared, what about timeline, right? What can we achieve, say, in the next year or two? Or what kind of timeline have you proposed for these actions?
We eventually put in a timeline, and I think everything needs to be done yesterday, if we could, of course. So it's, you need to do something dramatic in the next 6 months. You can't sit down and plan anymore right now. You need to implement things. And as I've said, one of the key things is bringing in extra manpower into the school to support the teachers. Universal design learning, the things that Ranjini and I are talking about changing our education system, I think that's a longer term thing. We don't mind that taking time to come. But today, we must support the teacher and the child in the class with their educational crisis that they're facing. And there are different age groups that we need different initiatives for. The younger ones need their basic literacy and numeracy skills. The older ones need to decide, are they continuing education or are they moving into a vocational thing? Do they need to do catch up? So I think we've drawn up that line for 3 months, 6 months, and a year in the report. And I think a lot of that can be done within 6 months if there is a national mandate, if there's a national will, if we recognize that this is a crisis that our children are facing. And Siawak, can I say that here we're talking only about MOE schools. 30% of our kids are not in MOE schools. 30% of our kids are in religious schools, in private schools, in home schools, in other schools. And we don't really know what's happening in them. We hope it's better there, but we don't really know. And we need to also find out what's happening to our special needs kids and our typically developing kids in those areas as well.
Mm. Rajini, are you seeing perhaps, what would you call it, drop out or children with special needs just with their families just choosing not to have them in school, you know, for a foreseeable period?
Yeah, so the parents who can afford it are opting more and more for private options. The parents who can't afford it are just not sending their kids to school, Shawik, because they don't see the point. And because for some of them, when they go to school, you know, all the parents get are, you know, feedback.
Complaints.
You know, complaints, messages in WhatsApp from the teacher, your child didn't do this. I don't think he should come to school tomorrow, you know, things like that. So it's hard across the board, but, you know, those in the lower socioeconomic group are going to be the ones that suffer the most. And you know, people should stop looking at it as how quickly it is that we need to catch up, in the sense that if those foundations are not there, children lose that motivation to learn. And at the end of the day, and as the document that Amma and group wrote, it has long-term implications for our economy. Yeah, we talk about the fact that early intervention saves the government's money if we put in early intervention and maximize potentials of children. Here we're talking about across the board education. So imagine if we don't do anything now, the cost to our economy, which is already struggling. I think one thing I liked about one of the proposals that Aman Group put out there, it's like you said, it's not about changing the whole education system, but putting in some help in terms of manpower, but also, the timelines that they put in there, about the fact that, for kids entering standard one, what is it, the timeline of when you should work towards the first term, the second term, the third term, and the fact that moving up to the next year, use the first term to recap and make sure that their foundations from the first year is already there, because that way at least we prepare children as they move further up and make sure that those foundations are strong.
Sorry, could I add that one other very important thing we need to do is go downstream. Our problem has not ended. Since we have lost a lot of preschool services, we have lost a lot of our early intervention program services. If we don't resurrect the services, we don't inject resources nationally into these services, then we're going to prolong our learning loss in our special needs kids. We have very few of these services as it is. And right now, we've lost quite a number of them, 25% of them. We need to have a governmental, national support. We've suggested 50% of the overheads and 50% of the staff's wages as a means to bring back these services. Otherwise, we're prolonging our education loss in our country.
Mm, and I think the fear is as more children are kept out, they're slipping through the cracks. The system doesn't recognize them and therefore doesn't recognize that there is that huge need that's not being addressed. Obviously, things need to be done yesterday. If we had the blueprint already implemented, we will be starting at a better or rebuilding at a better place, wouldn't we? But just very quickly before we wrap up, what can parents do? We've talked a lot about the system, the teachers. Parents have been doing as much as they can, perhaps more beyond their capacity, really. They've been trying to DIY a lot of solutions, as we heard from the parent who tweeted in, what can Amar, in the context of the recommendations you prepared, what can parents do within that?
I think first of all, don't go alone. Get together with other parents. I think it's critical. I think if you're a mother or father with a child with special needs, get together with other parents with special needs, and also with professionals. I think we are here. I think pediatricians, psychologists, therapists are there to support you. So first of all, get together. To have a group that will support each other. Secondly, I think we must engage both our teachers, our schools, and MOE. And we must be supportive. I don't think we want to go there and point a finger and say, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? No, we want to support him and say, hey, we've got some capacity. Can we bring resources in? If you can't hire an extra teacher, maybe we can collectively do that and bring a teacher in into the class for our child. So I think a lot of local solutions are going to be necessary while we wait for a national plan to emerge. I think that parents can generate local solutions. Thirdly, I think as a parent, you must know your child's status, both their educational needs, their emotional and social capabilities right now, and you must provide as far as you can support at home in tandem to what's happening in school. I always found my education was diverse. It wasn't just in school. I learned out with peers outside the home, and I also learned a lot in the home, good and bad, of course. When parents fight, it was bad. But you learn quite a bit from different things. So I think parents must invest in children's time. Time to put down our screens and time to spend a lot more time with our children.
All right. And a final word, Amar, to just, that push for the government to take on these recommendations.
What we do for our special needs children will benefit every child in Malaysia. That's one thing we have recognized from all the research and data. And I think if we do not invest in these children right now, if we leave children behind right now, educationally in Malaysia, we are going to pay the price 20, 30 years down the road, both in our economy, in the social fabric of our country. The less people you have who are economically capable, the more social unrest you will have in the country. So I think leave no child behind right now. It's our nation's future we're talking here.
Dr. Rajini, your final message?
Yeah, I think, you know, taking on from what Amma said about, you know, don't go it alone. Parents need to get together with schools. You know, the PIBGs can step in to help out in providing manpower. I know, you know, in the past, having had children in the education system here, the PIBGs did so much. Yeah. And there's so much potential. I know things are now just getting back to some sort of normality and parents are starting to get more involved in schools and stuff. But if we can't wait for the people in Putrajaya to send down the message locally, parents need to work with schools to see how they can support schools in supporting their children.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for speaking to me today, Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, and Dr. Amar Singh, consultant pediatrician and advisor to the National Early Childhood Intervention Council. You've been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.